we begin this afternoon, I want to really admonish you that what you're going to be seeing are not things to be fearful of. They're signposts on the road home. Okay? When you get in an airliner and the captain advances the thrust levers and the ground starts going by a whole lot faster than seems safe, that's not danger. Your only safety is in speed. Okay? And so what we're going to be seeing this afternoon will be signposts on the road home. Think about it in those terms. Your neighbors may have the right to be worried. You don't. Okay? Because you have access to the Word of God. Let's begin where I began this morning. That is, in one hand, $1,000. And it doesn't take much to create that, does it? That's $1,000. In the other hand, 1 ounce of gold. That's the U.S. coin, $50 gold piece, which years ago you could have bought for about $35 an ounce. Today, that piece of gold would cost you upwards of $1,300. Which suggests that something is really dynamically changing in our economy. And before you listen too long and hard to the TV hucksters who are trying to sell you gold as a security device, wait till we're done this afternoon and you hear what the Apostle James and what the Lord has to say about gold. Okay? I mean, I'd a whole lot rather be handling this in my left hand, that metal in this paper right now. But neither one of them offers the kind of security people really need. And I have been told, although I haven't read all several thousand pages of the health care bill, that buried within that bill is a provision by which government will monitor and regulate the sale and purchase of gold. Now, what that has to do with health care, I'm still trying to figure out. But before you go too far on this kind of worldly security, recognize that we're reaching a point in human history in which the only real security is basically knowing the Lord. All right, with that in mind, think about what's happening to our economy. One piece of gold, 1 ounce of gold, $1,300. A lot of people are beginning to get worried. America has just spent $2 trillion in the last couple of years. By the way, how much is $1 trillion? That's more than I got on me, I'll tell you that. Here's $1,000, okay? Now, $1,000 of these would be $1 million. $1,000 of these you could put in a relatively small backpack. How much is $1 billion? Well, let's kind of put it into terms we can relate to. This banker's box here, if filled with $100 bills, would hold about $2.4 million. You can put almost $2.5 million in this box. $1 billion would be about 417 of these boxes filled with $100 bills. You could probably get that in a rental truck. Good size one. Now, how much is $1 trillion? That is 417,000 of these things. That's enough to cover a football field and out beyond the sidelines. Completely fill it with $100 bills nearly a foot deep, larger than a football field. We've just done two of those in the last couple of years. Well, I guess the next logical question is, how are we going to pay for that? And the answer comes in several parts. Let me put up here on the board, if I can, so we can kind of organize what we're talking about, some of the problems the world is facing. And right now, the primary problem is the economy. Now, how are we going to pay for the amount of indebtedness that we have just undertaken? Well, one obvious thing is raise taxes, the way we usually do it. By the way, we have just spent, just in the last couple of years, More money than America has spent on every war in the history of our republic from the beginning, from the revolution on. That's how much we've spent. Do you know how much it takes to fight a war? Have any of you noticed in the last year or two that there's a tax suddenly missing from your telephone bill? Have you seen that? Now, there's so much fine print on those, I wouldn't be surprised if you haven't. But yeah, a tax has disappeared. You know what the tax was for? It was designed to pay for the Spanish-American War. Well, we finally got the thing paid for in about a century and a few years plus. And the Spanish-American War lasted, what, all of about 3 weeks? That's how expensive war is. We have just spent more than we have put into the cost of every war in our history, $2 trillion. Now then, how do we hope to pay for this? Well, the economy poses a challenge, and one option for paying for our default in the economy is to raise taxes. The only problem with that is that raising taxes has a lot of profound effects on our society at large. You can probably be looking forward to higher marginal tax rates, higher upper end, higher estate and gift tax rates. That's what really hurts us. When somebody owns a family farm out here, you know, east of Denver or Loveland, and it's several hundred acres, and the government comes along because grandpa dies and says, well, you got $4 or $5 million worth of land there. Pay up at the rate of 55%. The family can't raise 55%. They got to sell the land to just pay estate taxes. Now the family farm has disappeared, but something else has happened. In order to raise the money to pay estate taxes, they had to sell the farm, which grandpa bought for $10 an acre. So your tax basis in the farm is nothing. And when you sell it for $2-3 million or four, the government comes along, you do this just to pay the estate tax, the government comes along and says, aha, you have capital gains tax to pay on that. So you pay tax on the money you raise by selling the family farm in order to pay estate tax. It gets ugly. Well, when taxes go up, people's behavior tends to moderate. You know, if something has a tax effect, you begin thinking, is there a way I could structure this transaction differently so it doesn't have a taxable effect? If things get bad enough, what people tend to do is to go off the books into an underground economy. I'm not saying it's right. I'm a tax attorney. I defend people all the time who do this. I got somebody right now locked up in the Federal Detention Center in Los Angeles who tried this. He's getting out soon. He got a sweetheart of a deal. We worked hard for him, but it doesn't work. I'm not saying this is right. I'm saying it's what people do. So basically the motivation would be, you're thinking to yourself, if I mow the neighbor's lawn for $10 and government is raising taxes, they're going to come along and say, okay, congratulations on the $10 you just made. Give us four of them. By the time you get done paying federal and state and sometimes city taxes, you'll wind up effectively close to a 40% rate. Well, if that gets bad enough, people's temptation is to think to themselves, I don't want to give the government $4 out of the $10 I worked. It's not worth it to me. So you say to your neighbor, look, I'll mow your lawn if you'll paint my porch. Bingo! What have you got? A cash-free transaction that's off the books, the underground economy. Now government doesn't know what's going on. Do they get a little upset when that happens? Yeah, they do. And for the very common sense reason that in order to spend all the money that government spends, they've got a budget, a predictable tax inflow. And if you're not reporting income, if you're doing things off the books, government hasn't the foggiest idea how much money they're going to have next year or how much more they're going to have to borrow. So they make it a federal crime. You'll find it in the 7000 series of the Internal Revenue Code. Don't go there. You don't want to be there. Okay? Because when that steel door slams shut behind you, believe me, the bolt sounds like the bolt of a 50 caliber machine gun going shut. I go in and out of the Federal Detention Center all the time to see clients, and when the door shuts behind you, you want to hope that that stamp they put on your hand that responds to ultraviolet light doesn't fade. Because if that thing doesn't glow on the way out, you don't get out. So, taxes tend to change people's behavior. Societal behavior changes and government becomes concerned, and it pushes government in the direction of thinking to itself, we have to have a better way to monitor who's out there, who you are, what you're earning, what you're spending, and thus what you owe us in tax. And we'll get to that point in just a few seconds. Watch as we discover how all of these societal problems we face today push government in the direction of wanting and needing to know who you are and as much about you as they possibly can. Just incipient logic. So if government raises taxes, it, number one, probably won't pay that $2 trillion bill. Number two, it will introduce into society other issues, such as business just pulling back and saying, until we know how much money we're going to have to spend to give over in taxes, we're not buying any new equipment, we're not hiring anybody, we're just going to hold on and hope to survive. And a bad recession can become a worse recession under those circumstances. A very, very tough decision. Very tough issues government has to face. Well, if raising taxes doesn't work, there's something else we can do. And that is, we can borrow. In other words, governmentally, we can pay the mortgage with the MasterCard. And don't laugh, I've had tax clients who do it. Credit. We'll just make the house payments with a Visa card. Well, now the problem is, who issues our international Visa card? Foreign countries. We owe China in excess of $800 billion. It's pushing a trillion. We owe the Middle East collectively something like $3.8 trillion. We are now approaching the point where our debt service will soon equal 90% of our gross national product. When it reaches 100%, you have definitional bankruptcy. Now, the thing to be concerned about is, at some point, will not foreign creditors stop and think, wait a second, are they worth trusting with our money? When they don't, that option of borrowing disappears. See, we're going hand in hand to an increasingly skeptical world, to lenders who, sensing our weakness, are already talking, not very quietly, about switching to some other currency rather than the dollar for international trade. And they're beginning to dictate foreign policy to us on critically important subjects. I mentioned this morning, a nuclear Iran is one, a nuclear North Korea is another, and China is the one nation that could intermediate at least with one of those, and we owe them so big we really don't have much of a lever arm to pull on. There is the problem we're working into. Our geoeconomic problem is becoming a geopolitical problem, and we're doing it simply because we are going to foreign countries to fund our lifestyle. Is there a chance one day we'll stick the national Visa card in the international cash extraction machine, pull it back out, and across the screen comes printed the ugly word, declined? What if we can't borrow enough to service this debt? What happens then? Overnight, we have 13 football fields covered a foot deep in $100 bills that we owe, because that's where we are right now. And we're unable to pay. Well, what on earth do we do then? Well, let's move on. There's something else you can do. Something else a country can do when it can't raise money any other way is simply this. That's what you do. These are real, by the way. I didn't create them on the office Xerox machine. I got these from the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. That's the way money comes out, these big sheets of dollar bills, all the way up to high denominational bills. Government resorts to printing money. Well, what's wrong with that? You print too much of this, now the laws of supply and demand go into effect, don't they? You've printed more of a commodity than there is demand for it, so therefore what? The value goes where? The value declines, and you've introduced an ugly word called hyperinflation. Hyphenated word, hyperinflation. When it happens, things go bad very quickly. I have on order right now, it hasn't come yet, but I have on order a German mark printed in the 1920s. After the First World War, Germany was saddled with very, very heavy reparations that they had to pay that were imposed on them by the victorious allies, Britain, France, and the United States. And their economy was just in shambles. Their country was in shambles. World War I had just torn mainland Europe to pieces. They had no industry to speak of initially, and so they had to pay these huge payments, but they didn't have the marks to pay them with. So guess what they did? The Reichstag said, let's do a stimulus package. Let's stimulate the German economy by printing marks. Let's inject money into the economy. And what happened to the mark? Well, what happened to the mark was that in 1921, $1 would buy you, or I should say in 1919, $1 would buy you 12 marks, reasonably decent rate of exchange, right after the war. 2 years later, a dollar would buy you 263 marks. 2 years after that, it would buy you 4.6 million marks. And what I have on order is a 5 million mark note. In 1924, a dollar would buy you 4.2 trillion marks. That's hyperinflation. Now, the piece of German money I have ordered is only printed on one side. I've been wanting to get one of these for years, because for years I've been saying how, you know, the mark got so worthless, it wasn't worth ink for both sides of the paper. They were only printing it on one side. Well, I'm finally going to get a hold of one of those rascals so I can hold it up and show it to you. And so there are these stories going around how the Germans would just carry wheelbarrow loads of million-dollar marks just piled high to go downtown and buy a loaf of bread. When hyperinflation hits, when that ugly thing hits, if you can still afford to go to a restaurant and buy a meal, you pay for your meal when you order it. You don't wait till you've eaten it because the price will have gone up. So here comes Heinrich down the street with his wheelbarrow full of marks, and his friend Gerhard is walking with him. They go to the bakery. All he wants is a simple little loaf of bread. He leaves the wheelbarrow outside, and Gerhard says, Heinrich, don't leave it out here. Somebody will steal it. He says, there's nobody, no way anybody will steal that stuff. It's so worthless. And he was right. When he came back out to pay for his bread, his money was there in a heap. Somebody had stolen the wheelbarrow. That is hyperinflation. Now, could that be in the future? I want to transition over now from what's going on in our world to what the Bible and Spirit of Prophecy tell us will happen in an end time world, and then you put it together and see if you see any connection there. Revelation 18 has some fascinating suggestions about an end time economy. If you want to follow along, I strongly suggest you do. Presumably, you brought your swords, right? Sword of the Word of God. HMS Richards Jr. once sent me a fascinating book written basically on how to argue a case in court. Harold had gotten a kick out of it, sent it to me. And in the flyleaf he wrote, this book is useful, but never forget the old sword, meaning the Word of God. How much I miss Brother Harold Richards, how much I miss his dad. And I thank God you've got a school here named after HMS. It's a worthy accolade to a really decent man. Well, in any event, Revelation 18:1 says, after these things I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, has become a dwelling place of demons. Now let's stop there a second. Revelation 14, verses 8 through 11, also contain a parallel warning about Babylon. We talked about that this morning. We didn't have time to get into it, but I want to do it now. Four of the seven verses in Revelation 14 that comprise the Advent message, what we're commissioned to deliver to the world, four, over half of them, deal with this end time thing, this phenomenon called the fall of Babylon. And let's stop a second before we go any further on the economy, and let's figure out why the Bible uses a prehistoric city to symbolize an end-time postmodern problem. It doesn't seem to make any sense until you do some sensible biblical research and say, if the Bible puts it there, there is meaning there, something must have happened in ancient Babylon that will be repeated at the end of time. Does that make sense to you, Pastor? Because here's the pro. I'm an amateur at this. I oftentimes wish that I had done what the Lord impressed me to do when I just graduated from law school. I got a very strong impression, go back and take theology and become a minister. And I ran from that like Jonah, and I joined the Navy. And I never recovered. So I defer to the experts, those who really understand this. But it seems to me a sensible thing to do is to say, did ancient Babylon make a mistake that's going to be repeated at the end of time? Well, to analyze that, you go back and say, what mistakes did Babylon make? Well, number one, right after the flood, here's this group of people fat and happy down in that warm desert country right around where Baghdad is now. And they get to thinking, the Lord said He wasn't going to send another flood, but what if He changes His mind? Why don't we build a tower so if God's promise isn't good, we will have created a place of safety for ourselves? So what's the first mistake of Babylon? Didn't believe the promises of God. Absolutely. Mistake number one, you don't believe the promises of God. Could that get repeated at the end of time? And could frighten people who don't believe the promises of God about an end-time Lord returning to save His faithful people, could they make a catastrophic mistake with this whole planet? Yes, they could. Well, when you don't believe the promises of God, you got to believe in something. So what are you going to believe in? All you got left is yourself. So they believed in themselves. They started making mud bricks by the billions. I had a lot of fun with that in the book, The Lucifer Diary. Lucifer and his angels laughing their heads off at these fools, thinking they're going to build a tower across the cosmic radius to heaven out of mud bricks. So they have acres and acres, square miles of bricks. They start making a tower. And what's that? They're building their own way to heaven with what? Human works. Following me? You don't believe the promises of God. Mistake number one. Mistake number two. You are then going to attempt to find heaven through what? Through human works. That may take the form of asking yourself, have I done enough so that Allah will accept me in the day of judgment? Or it may take the form of saying, have I said enough prayers? Enough decades of prayers? Or it might take the form, let me be careful here because I don't want to be misunderstood. It might take the form of us being in this lovely church on Sabbath only because we want to get to heaven. Okay? Nothing wrong with being here on Sabbath. We're supposed to be here. When the Lord finished working with matter at the end of creation week, He switches from matter, from things you can touch and feel, to this abstraction called time. And He builds a temple in time. The last act of creation is an abstraction. He takes time, this great imponderable that drags us along away from youth, away from memories, away from people we love. Involuntarily, we're born on it. The Lord takes that mighty river of time. He says, I'm going to make something out of it. He makes a temple in time, and He says, every 7 days, you're going to find yourself here, and when you get there, on your knees. This place is holy. So it's perfectly right to be here on Sabbath. But for the right reason. To be here only because we want to get to heaven is a poor second of being here just because we love Jesus. It's a big difference, okay? I don't want to be misunderstood on that, but what I'm saying is, even we could respond to wonderful things like the law of God in a way not dissimilar from what the people in Babylon did. We believe the promises of God, but kind of like Abraham and Hagar, we're going to give the Lord a little help by working our way to heaven. That's a mistake we just don't dare make. The only title we have to heaven is the same one the thief on the cross had. We don't deserve it, but because of Him, we can have it. That's the gospel. So Babylon makes two mistakes. Don't believe the promises of God. Try to work their way to heaven, but there's a third one they make. And for that one, you got to wait several hundred years. Civilizations come and go in the Mesopotamian plains there. And finally, this great warrior chief named Nebuchadnezzar rises up, and he has a dream. And the dream is he sees all the way down to the end of time, all the way to the portals of the second coming, and he sees this layered image, this mud man made of various layers of metal and mud. Then he rebels and he says, wait a second, Babylon isn't going to be just the head. It's going to be the whole thing. And to symbolize that, he creates this monster statue, 90 feet tall, 9 feet across the shoulders, solid gold. Brings it onto the plain of Dura, calls the world in assembly, and then what does he do? He says, this is not just a political event, this is a religious service. When the orchestra starts, on your knees, bow before this thing I've created. A world religion enforced by what? Force of arms. Could that happen at the end of time? So there you've got the reason why, in four verses of Revelation 14, Adventists are to proclaim to the world, don't repeat those mistakes. The promises of God are sure, you can believe in them. Number two, don't try to rely on yourself, because you've got nothing to offer heaven except your willing obedience. And number three, don't make the mistake of trying to force morality just because you're frightened of where America is going. So, Revelation 18 sees this angel coming down from heaven having a great authority and saying, Babylon is fallen. Now, what we're about to read here is one of the few passages where the Bible even hints at an economic forecast. Most of the time, the Bible talks about economics only in terms of how you responsibly manage your wealth. But here, in a very few places, it talks about economic events. And in Revelation 18:11, we get a hint of hyperinflation. Take a look at verse 11. The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver and every object. All the things which are rich and splendid have gone from you. You shall find them no more. This thing is terminal. It's end time terminal. And the merchants who became rich by her will stand at a distance, weeping and wailing, saying, alas, for in 1 hour so much riches is gone. 1 hour. Now you got to understand this. The Greek word for hour there is the word hurrah. It looks like that in Greek. It's defined, if I don't kill myself getting down here, it's defined, basically, as a very short, indeterminate period of time. It's not a literal hour. It's not a prophetic hour. It's just a short period of time. Be thankful it is, because that same word is applied to the time of trouble. It doesn't last long. Praise the Lord, it isn't here long. It's here long enough to perfect our character, so we turn loose of earth and trust in Him alone. All right. So Revelation 18 talks about this very sudden economic collapse. Now look at verse 17 and then 18. Global implications here of world trade going bad. Every shipmaster, all who travel by ship, and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance, cried out, weeping and wailing, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich, for in 1 hour she's made desolate. I mean, they go and they have a good cry. Something goes wrong in world commerce, and it happens fast. All right? Now turn to the book of James. You'll see the same thing happening there. James chapter 5, verse 1. And the apostle there is speaking to people who have accumulated a lot of wealth. And he says, come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted. Your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are what? What's the next word? A lot of modern translations use the word corroded. Some use the word rusted. All of them are chemically impossible. Look at this stuff. This gold, for example, is almost chemically inert. There's almost nothing will attack it. You take two very powerful laboratory acids, put them together, and you can dissolve gold, but that's about the only way you do it. Silver, you know, you housewives know, it may tarnish, but all you got to do is take a polishing cloth, take that black surface off, and it's just as shiny as ever. Neither of these things rust. And yet, James talks about this kind of perceived stable wealth as just going through your fingers like so much rust. Chemically impossible, unless the rules of chemistry would change economically impossible unless the rules of economics would change, and at the end of time, something really goes bad. It's very obvious James is talking to an end-time world because he says you've heaped up treasures when? In the last days. An end-time prophecy. Now notice that Jesus also uses the metaphor of rust. Matthew 6:19. Jesus advises us, lay not up for yourselves treasures on the earth where moth and rust doth corrupt and where thieves break through and steal. Once again, he has this whole concept of wealth disintegrating on you. But now he adds the concept of thievery, somebody stealing it. And the question that I want to ask you is, does a thief always have to be a bad guy with a black mask over his eyes, using a crowbar to enter in through your bedroom window? Could a thief be a governmental policy that borrows from the future money it knows can never be repaid and that may drive a nation into bankruptcy? Is that a possibility? In other words, what Jesus is talking about is a time when things go so bad they may be irreversible. Sobering hints about inflation and currency collapse. Now, let me turn to another source that I consider inspired, and that's the spirit of prophecy. I mean, am I allowed to derive anything as an authority source from the spirit of prophecy here? Let me tell you a quick story. Those Mormon missionaries that come around, I sure admire them. I disagree with them theologically, but when I see those young fellows dressed up nice, giving 2 years of their lives to serve a mission for their church, I have to admire their sincerity. When they come to my home, I'm always courteous to them. One day, some couple of them came by and they invited me to go to the local stake the next Sunday, and I did. By the way, are you aware that Mormons, when the church first started out, were Sabbath keepers? They kept the seventh-day Sabbath. I've challenged them on that. They've read it up on it, researched it, and they agree with me. Well, something happened. They're now Sunday keepers. Anyway, I went down to the local stake. When I went in there, I would have been very upset if they had noticed that a visitor was present. So we better not talk about the word of wisdom or the celestial kingdom or, heaven forbid, Joseph Smith. I went there because I wanted to hear this stuff. I wanted to hear where they were coming from. Why? Because I was in a Mormon church. Well, we're in an Adventist church this afternoon, aren't we? And I want to talk about the spirit of prophecy. Now, in the spirit of prophecy, there's several interesting hints at the probability of hyperinflation. In Maranatha, page 173... Ellen White wrote, "The Lord has shown me that some of His children would fear when they see the price of food rising. They would buy food and lay it up for the time of trouble." So it's obviously way down near the end of time. God's people feel fear when they see the price of food rising. Now that is not ordinary inflation. All of us have seen the price of food rise. I mean, in my lifetime, I've seen it when you could buy a loaf of bread for 35 cents. It's now $3.50 or more. We've all seen the price of food rise. This is not ordinary inflation. None of us have felt fear yet. Fear is when mom says to dad, "I don't like what I'm seeing on the evening news. Maybe it's time, cut the mattress open, get the money out. Let's go down and buy some flour and some beans and whatever else you think we may need to get through till the Lord comes." Now, by the way, Ellen White says it doesn't work that way. Those who try doing that, she said, in a time of need, they went to their food, they looked at it, it had bred worms, was full of living creatures, and not fit for use. Why? Because the time of trouble isn't engineered so that we can learn how to really be, you know, self-sufficient. The time of trouble was designed to pry our claws out of this world to where we got nothing left but the Lord. And that perfects our characters to the point where we step on almost on the level into heaven. The last day on earth is almost like the first day in heaven. We're so in tune with heaven that being there is just natural. Isn't that the way it ought to be? I don't understand why people say, "I'm going to go right on watching the big screen TV and bathing my mind in Hollywood until the Lord comes and He'll take it all away from me." Well, it don't work that way. In any event, Ellen White also said in Christian Service, page 158, "The work which the church has failed to do in a time of peace and prosperity, she will have to do in a terrible crisis under the most forbidding, discouraging circumstances." Now, that tells me that prosperity disappears. We could have done it once. The Lord's work in a time of prosperity. Time of prosperity ends, and we have to do it in a hard time of hardship. Now, there's one more quote I want to share with you because it's just so clear. You can find it for yourself in Evangelism, page 62. Money, she says, I'm quoting her words, money will soon depreciate in value very suddenly. That is hyperinflation. This stuff loses its value, and it loses its value suddenly. When does that happen? She says it happens when the reality of eternal scenes opens to the senses of man. In other words, in connection with the final events on earth. Hyperinflation. Well, we've just authorized trillions of new dollar bills backed by nothing but the hope that we'll find lenders to back them up. And if the lenders quit lending or flex their creditor muscles, an economic crisis becomes a geopolitical crisis. What I'm saying is we better pray that Congress and the White House are right on this issue, because they've just bet the country on the assumption they are. Think about this. Revelation 13 makes it clear that the United States will be able to dictate to the world at the end of time. If we're going to have that kind of power at the end of time, it better happen soon, because we're fast losing it. So, we have three responses to the economy there, none of which seem to work very well. And all of which then leads to another problem. And that is loss of liberty. We've just described an array of problems that hurt people where it really counts. They hurt and they just keep on hurting. There's nothing like an economic crisis that hangs on to just really hurt and keep hurting. And from there, it's a short step to where people feel fear. It goes from annoyance to inconvenience to outright fear. And frightened people tend to then revert to a kind of primitive herding mentality. They clump together in a primitive herding mentality done by instinct, and they become willing to throw liberty away. Now, let's see where this possibly leads. Loss of liberty. Congress faces this enormous avalanche of problems that can only be dealt with by really knowing who you are and where you are, what you're making, what you're spending. Let's assume, for example, that in some time of hyperinflation, we've printed money, it's rapidly losing value. Money is losing value at the same time when the cost of commodities is rising. People are still out of work, they're getting poorer, and the cost of stuff is going up, and that's called stagflation. That's the nightmare scenario. We had a little taste of it right after the economic embargo from the oil embargo of the Middle East back in the Jimmy Carter era. It cost him a second term of presidency, and we pulled out of that. But if you have stagflation, what do people tend to do? They become frightened. Prices are going up. The black market now becomes an option. Government is desperate to try to control prices. And one of the natural things the government would do would be to impose wage and price controls. Let's get inflation under control. It's happened. Nixon tried it. It didn't work, but he tried it. Now, if the government is trying to control wages and prices, as long as this stuff here is in circulation, as long as people can trade money for goods, the government has a very tough time of controlling how much you pay for something. If, for example, in the black market, supposing we had another oil embargo, goods were rationed and people need oil, so they buy it from each other outside the normal sources of government. Government seeks to control that. The most logical need government would face would be to issue a national identity card. Very logical solution. Nothing inherently immoral with it. My prediction is it probably would be the same size and shape as your credit card, because government would say that's what they're used to carrying. They've already sacrificed their privacy to the credit card and the internet. They've got no gripe about this. And on this thing, biometrically engineered, would be your name, your social security number, probably your insurance data, probably your tax return, tax compliance records, your medical records, your entitlement to national health care, your immigration records if you're an immigrant. Everything about you would be put on this card, and it would be biometrically engineered with retinal scans or whatever, so that theoretically at least nobody could use this thing claiming to be you. And government would say this solves a host of problems. What about the immigration problem? If we issue these, we know who's supposed to be here. If they don't have one of these counterfeit-proof cards, quote-unquote, we know they're here illegally. And by the way, this would give government the chance to get inflation under control by doing what? Pulling money out of circulation, requiring all of your wealth to be deposited in accounts that can be accessed only electronically. It sounds far-fetched, but believe me, we're not that far from it. We're perfectly capable of doing this. It would solve a lot of problems. You would carry your medical records with you. If you're in a wreck, they don't have to worry about getting your x-rays from your home hospital. They got them on here. Your blood type, your whole health history could be here. There are a lot of good things could happen from a national identity card, and government would be very adept at basically selling those good ideas to you. But if all money were pulled out of circulation and this is the thing you had to use at the cash register, now government could control prices. Easy. Anybody who paid more than they were supposed to would instantly show up on a government computer. You think that's not possible? Don't raise your hands, but anybody here ever been audited by the IRS? You know how your return was probably selected for audit? It's called a DIF score, Discriminant Income Function Test. There are models done in these huge government computers. They're highly classified. We in the practitioner community don't have access to them, but they will show where you depart from a typical taxpayer in your economic stratum, in your income level. You give more than the average individual, for example, of charitable entities like the church, and you get a little letter from the IRS saying basically your return has been selected for audit. We've been examining Schedule A. Please provide by the following date front and backs of all checks made payable to any charity, receipts from any charity for gifts in excess of $250, and further information we may be requesting you provide. And you wind up going to the IRS with your canceled check simply because you gave more than other people in your income group do, you know, and you missed the DIF score. The Discriminant Income Function Test kicked your return out for audit. We're perfectly capable of doing that now with income tax returns. It would be a short step for government computers to be able to monitor wages and prices in an attempt not to do something bad, but in an attempt to restore stability to a very shaky economy in which a lot of people are getting hurt. My conviction is that the end of time problems described in Revelation 14, 8 through 11 are not from bad people trying to do bad things. They're from good people who want nothing more than to try to save the country, get things back on a decent level of stability, and return America to the good days. And those who don't conform will be seen as standing in the way of that. Loss of liberty. A national identity card would certainly be one way to do it. Nothing inherently immoral about that. What concerns me is that it opens the door then for a fulfillment of prophecy. And now, you would find yourself without an identity card, you couldn't buy or sell. Your net worth is now a series of ones and zeros in a government computer. And that leads you to a point, quite basically, where we have to look at end time predictions. And now let's go back to the book of Revelation. Revelation 13, verse 1. Revelation 13, verse 1. Now we're going to see globalism happen, and we're going to see it make a catastrophic end-time mistake. And I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on its horns ten crowns, and on its heads the name of blasphemy. There is enough symbolism in that one verse to take you through a whole semester of graduate school.
I stood on the sand of the sea. What's he looking at? What does the water represent in the Bible? People. The waters you saw were peoples, nations, tongues. It just never ceases to amaze me how cleverly the Bible uses symbolism in a very accurate way. Thank you. Water is inherently unstable, just like people. Water can be just absolutely beautiful and placid, just like people. Water, when wind blows on it, when strife blows on it, can be as ugly as anything you ever saw. I've been through two tropical cyclones on the high seas, one in the Formosa Straits, one off the west coast of Mexico. Believe me, they're not habit-forming. When you stand on the bridge of a warship, 30 feet above the water, and you're looking up at waves, you'd just as soon be anywhere but there. So people represented by water is very, very apt. They're fluid. They will assume the shape of any container they're in, whether it's a beautiful thing like the U.S. Constitution or Germany during World War II. Thank you. So John is looking at the people of the earth, and he sees a beast rise up out of the sea. Now, what do beasts represent? Beasts represent a political or religious power, don't they? The thing has 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, what do those numbers suggest to you? They're both biblically significant. 7 is a biblical number of perfect completion.